The Idle One to request his immediate arrest and presence in the UK, and I'd rather not prolong it. He'll fight it like buggery. But we don't need him anymore. We've got what we want. Breakthrough time, now we know who and who's paying. Rupert broke his golden rule and swore aloud on the phone. He never swore aloud when his boss was on the line, but he did now. Shit, he said with pleasure. Bastard obviously thinks it's romantic lives for cash. It's about as romantic as syphilis, and you can get it a bloody sight cheaper in Chechnya, Kosovo, or Sarajevo. I'd bet this scumbag's making millions. Sure, his boss muttered. Sure, you can pick up a killer for a song in Sarajevo and Chechnya, but not with this style and the Shakespearean quotations. In London, Rupert's boss put down her telephone, and in London they fed the name into one of the magic machines. Chermiet, Ilyich Antonovich. The machine thought about it for a couple of human heartbeats, then spat it all out. Chermiet was known both at Thames House and Vauxhall Bridge Cross. Calls went nipping across the river, and then Chermiet's name was flashed into embassies and legations all over the place. Marked man, Chermiet, marked with a cross of blood. Home for Jimmy McLean was a splendidly appointed bungalow in an enclave surrounded and kept secure by the Garda, who had turned their backs and blindfolded themselves for the time being. Mickey Herring and Fatty Brimstone did the job faultlessly. Rupert briefed them, and they even had a peep at some photographs before they went in. A fellow they knew had made certain Jimmy had not planned anything on his own for that weekend. They got him home, stripped him, and popped him between the covers in the early hours of the Sunday morning. You could see Dublin Castle lying below them, from the big picture windows in his bedroom. When Jimmy woke up, drunk and slurring, he had a terrible thirst on him and felt heavy-headed, even unwell, late that night. He also had an enormous erection, but he got over it and settled in for a long sleep. Funny, he thought. He did not usually drink to excess, nor could he remember the details. When he woke again, a worm of concern was nagging away at him. The Garda arrived around 6 on the Sunday evening and pulled him out, cautioned him, and carted him off to Dublin Castle, put him in a cell and charged him with conspiracy. "If the Brits try to get you to London, you'll resist it, no doubt, Mr. McLean." "Sure I will." Jimmy gave the officer a wink. "But that's why you've charged me, right? I'll have to face this one before you'll even think of handing me over. What's it all about, anyway?" "If you don't know, we're not telling you, Jimmy, and that's the truth." Right, Jimmy thought. He wondered what was going on. His memory was dodgy, but he seemed to recall a girl with the face and voice of an angel. It was a couple of days before he really began to worry. Return to ring my rookie. It is a little after 4 o'clock on the Sunday morning. The Father Superior's door slashed open. "Talking about me behind my back." The malignant shape of Father Benedict stepped from the darkness outside, the two muscular monks hovering in his wake. "We have no reason to talk about you behind your back." Gregory Scott visibly bridled at Benedict. "Not even to discuss old times around the campfire, Father." The voice had not changed from that which Charlie remembered from all those years ago. Harsh, nasal, astringent. This voice was almost tangible, in that you could feel it dragging over you, trying to strip the skin from your face like acid. "So you remember me, Charlie Gauntlet?" "Remembered you before I saw you. Saw you at that crash site, when young Hillary almost got herself written off. And said to myself, 'I know that face.' Bingo. It reminded me of the camp. Same smell. Wood smoke, and the leaves gone from the trees." For the first time in ages, Charlie thought of his father. His good memories of his father were always of the old man in the garden, digging out trenches for potatoes, or picking the peas, shelling them around the kitchen table with his mother. His dad would get the breath knocked out of him by gardening too hard. He'd been gassed in the First War. He'd tell the story of how they got him to the docks on a stretcher, and he lay there crying because the boat had gone. "I missed the boat," he used to say. "Do that once, and you'll never do it again." In fact, a chunk of irony was attached to that experience, for the boat he'd missed struck a mine in the channel, and half the wounded on board were drowned. You don't change, Charlie told the former military policeman. You don't change one bit. He could smell the smoke from his father's garden incinerator and the apples laid out in a loft at one and the same time. Memories had their seasons. We're old and aged in the wood now. The former Corporal Knight's eyes told their own story. The one good thing is I don't have to call you sir like I did all those years ago. No, but that doesn't alter the natural superiority. Charlie smiled as he said it, trying to make a little barbed joke. Father Benedict, nay Colin Knight, gave him an unpleasant look and turned back to the Father Superior. I've just read the latest take from the Naomi Diaries. Benedict's smile was wretchedly unpleasant, like an old man's hand lingering where it should not have even strayed. It's wonderful. We should make a mint with this. I didn't know mints were involved. Charlie tried to sound innocent. In his head he saw cases full of cash and a dozen different currencies. He also saw the letters Gregory Scott had written to the bank manager in Melrose. Dear Arthur, hope all goes well. Then the other letter. This is the latest take, first draft only. And so on and so forth. And the name, Beridi, written on an envelope. Then you're naive, Charlie. It's keeping company with all these monks that does it. Father Benedict rasped. Really? As though Charlie had no interest in it. Yes, really, Charlie. There's always money in a good, solid monastery. Or didn't you know? I think you should get back to your cell. Get some rest, Charlie. Gregory Scott was speaking as though trying to smooth out something between him and the one-time military police corporal. Am I a prisoner? Somewhere, in the back of his head, Charlie reasoned that there was a distinct possibility that he could already be a dead man. Father Benedict was not a priest, but some kind of interloper. And by now, Charlie suspected that the monastery of St. Jerome was a giant laundromat, washing money whiter than the whitewash on the wall. He heard the words in his head. Whiter than the water where you washed your dirty daughter will be whiter than the whitewash on the wall. His father had sung it in the bath. Hear him all over the house, you could. If this was the case, they really would not want him outside, in the real world. He accepted that once here, he wasn't in the proper world. Of course, you're not a prisoner, Charlie. Gregory Scott still couldn't look him in the eye. You sure? We wouldn't keep you in here against your will. No. No, of course you wouldn't. And several images came into his head. A gun being fired close to a prisoner's head. Christ on the cross, the face sagging on the shoulder. And again back to the camp near Frankfurt, and Sergeant Hammer stretched out dead on the floor of the CO's office, with the big corporal leaning against the wall looking on. You mean you're going to let me go? Presently, the novice master said unconvincingly. Then he repeated it. Presently. By this time, the two stocky, muscular monks had moved into the room. Time you was in bed, one of them said, looking at Charlie with some distaste. Yes, time you was all tucked up, Charlie. The other monk, he could see, had what used to be called a cast in his right eye. You didn't see that so much these days. Perhaps they'd found some way of treating slight squints. They'd found so many cures for what were once quite serious handicaps. Babies born now, early in the millennium, could expect to live around 130 years. So advanced had medical science become. Come along, Charlie. You want to go faster so we can all get to rest? As the monk with the squint spoke, Charlie realized for the first time that they both had accents. The W was pronounced V, and they stressed some vowels, unlike a born Brit. He initially thought this was a regional thing, but on hearing them now he knew that they were Middle European, Czechs or Poles, or Albanians or Romanians, something like that. As they led him away, unprotesting, Charlie glanced back over his shoulder. Sometime I need to talk to you about Sergeant Hammer, he said, and watched Gregory Scott wince as though he'd been slapped in the face. There goes the neighbourhood, Charlie thought. There go my chances of promotion. There goes my life, possibly. Depends, he thought. Depends on what really happened in that office. Again, he saw the large, chubby sergeant dead on the floor. When was that? 51 or 52? Whenever. It was important. Heart attack, they said. Even the coroner said so. But, well, he'd been playing around with Sissel, Sergeant Hammer had. And until then, Sissel had been Major Scott's private preserve. In a way, Charlie thought, Sissel was like an updated Naomi, lassoed and corralled to do the Major's bidding, to slip among the camp's 100 or so inmates, and bring back tales to the Major's bed. It was difficult now, looking at the old priest, to remember this was once a man consumed with jealousy and lust for a thin, black-haired woman who was trying to buy herself a way back to her hometown with the only currency she had to offer. When they got to Charlie's cell, the door was open, and one of them pushed him in, quite gently, slamming the door behind him. A new, thick folder lay on the bed, so Charlie made himself comfortable and started to read on. In London, the machines had been working overtime. After identifying Chermiette, they set out to put a trace on him. Finally, he came back at last, identified at a restaurant in Sochi, on the Black Sea, 8 days ago. The last resort, some wag had labelled it. All same Key West, the last resort. Could be anywhere by now. Suddenly Chermiette became the most sought-after man on the planet. He was even given the pseudonym Checker One. And the Royal Air Force flew Bex Oleska and Patsy Wright from Northolt into Glasgow. There a big Chinook helicopter waited for them, the crew checking things out, busy, swarming around the beast. "You're right," a young pilot officer shouted at Patsy. "Well, I'm not wrong. Not often, anyway." The message was to tell them not to leave without being briefed by a bristling squadron leader, I.O., who had all the gen. They went into a flurry of buildings and finally huddled round a table in a room where military aircrew were coming and going all the time. The squadron leader said there were all kinds of problems, and that he had been entrusted with passing on a couple of names. The Oscar one is the Russian Federation president, and Madame Portunin. That makes sense? Perfect sense. Patsy's eyes slid across to Bex, who nodded, her face betraying shock as she took it in. Anything else? Yes, it implicates a known leader of the Sons and Daughters of October. That makes sense as well? Yes, there should be a name. There is. Chermiette, Ilyich Antonovich Chermiette, Checker One. After that, I was told to fold up my tent and steal away. The squadron leader had a big Battle of Britain moustache with waxed ends. When he smiled, as he did now, the ends seemed to curve upward. They actually said that I should kill off the brain cells where that information is stored. A word to the wise, old boy, said Patsy at his most languorous. I should take them pretty well literally. Tie a stone round that particular memory and drop it into the deepest ocean. And I do not jest. The squadron leader could tell that Patsy was not playing around and thought he could just feel the heat from hell brushing his cheek. At a little after 9 on the Sunday morning, the Chinook lifted off and headed west over the sea.